We are finally to the third cycle, and that's where we're at tonight. We are in cycle three, and when BJ wraps up next week, we will be done with the third cycle completely. And then there's an interlude. Actually, BJ will cover chapter 28 next week, too. And then in chapters 29, 30, and 31, Job covers, the reason I've lumped those together, Job covers his past, his present, and his future. And so that will all be on 1 week. Our gospel meeting is in there somewhere pretty close to that time period. And then we have this young man by the name of Elihu who has waited to speak. He's let all the older men speak. And now he jumps in and gives his first, second, and third answers. And then God comes into the scene and answers in a whirlwind. So we are more than halfway through the book, and we are making great progress. After tonight, we will be probably about 60% done with the book. So one of the things I know, I had a couple people talk to me, the book is so depressing at times. And yes, it is, but the exciting part is we being insiders to all this information, seeing kind of behind the curtain what's going on, we know it has a happy ending. But put yourself, all I can tell you is put yourself in Job's shoes and deal with and feel these things that he's been feeling because it's been pretty traumatic. And the slugfest continues as we continue tonight with round three with Eliphaz. So that's where we're going to start. And so we'll jump right into chapter 22. And I'll start with Kevin. Kevin, can you read 1 through 20? Of chapter 22, and then BJ, I'll have you read 21 through 30 of chapter 22.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Can a man be profitable to God? Surely he who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are in the right? Or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you? Is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities, for you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have given no water to the weary to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favored man lived in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. Therefore snares are all around you, and sudden terrors overwhelm you, for darkness, so that you cannot see, and a flood of water covers you. Is not God high in the heavens? See the highest stars, how lofty they are. But you say, what does God know? Can he judge through the deep darkness? Thick clouds veil him so that he does not see, and he walks on the vault of heaven. Will you keep to the old way that wicked men trod? They were snatched away before their time. Their foundation was washed away. They said to God, depart from us, and what can the Almighty do to us? Yet he filled their houses with good things. But the counsel of the wicked is far from them. The righteous see it and are glad. The innocent one mocks at them, saying, surely our adversaries are cut off, and what they left, the fire has consumed.
Agree with God and be at peace. Thereby good will come to you. Receive instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. If you remove injustice far from your tents, if you lay gold in the dust or gold of Ophir among the stones of the torrent bed, then the Almighty will be your gold and your precious silver. And then you will delight yourself in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. You will make your prayer to him and he will hear you, and you will pay your vows. You will decide on a matter and it will be established for you. The light will shine on your ways. For when they are humbled, you say it is because of pride. But he saves the lowly. He delivers even the one who is not innocent. Who will be delivered through the cleanliness of your hands?
Okay, thank you, Kevin and BJ. All right, in chapter 22, we have Eliphaz again accusing Job of wickedness. Now, you might remember earlier, it's always been in generalities, where it's you've done something sinful, we don't know what it is. We get specific tonight. And so Eliphaz starts pointing out, pinpointing some things that he thinks Job is very guilty of, so he pinpoints some specific sins. Now, you might remember earlier in rounds 1 and 2 with Eliphaz, he was more kind of a suave, sophisticated, kind, and more of a sympathetic man who defended a false position. but not really with any solid evidence. But right now he goes back onto the premise that all suffering is punishment for doing wrong. And the point being, Job is a great sufferer, therefore Job must be a great sinner. And like many people we face in this world, sometimes when the facts of the truth are not there, they'll resort to attacking a person's character or manufacturing charges or manufacturing some lies. So to start off with, in verses 1 through 4, Eliphaz asks and raises five questions here. He says, can a man be profitable to God? The first four, by the way, are all in the imperative no. Can a man be profitable to God, though he is wise, maybe profitable to himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you are righteous, or is it gain to him that you make your ways blameless? So these are kind of sarcastic questions, and these first four questions imply a negative answer of no. But on the fifth question, the fifth indicates Eliphaz's conclusion about Job's suffering. And in verse 4 he says, It is because of your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you. This is kind of a sarcastic remark. And then in right immediately verse 5 he goes into, is not your wickedness great? So Eliphaz is accusing Job of being wicked, and he concludes that God really would not have any personal, selfish, or ulterior motive for testing Job, that these things are happening because of his wickedness. And so that's really what he's going to lean on really heavily in this chapter. So in verse 3, I have a couple points here for you in verse 3, and that is he says, God gets no pleasure from wickedness, but it is not true that he derives no pleasure from the righteousness of his saints. We read about that many times in the passages. I put three of the Psalms there that talks about God takes great pleasure in the righteousness of his saints. And that's in Psalms 35, Psalms 147, and Psalms 149. And again, in verse 4, this is sarcastic. Eliphaz basically is saying, he's saying, Job, all this trouble happening, is it because of how much you fear God? So it's a sarcastic remark. You got to kind of put it in the context. And is it because of your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you? So he's being very, very sarcastic here. Of all these things have happened, is it because of your great righteousness, Job? And so Job is, again, being mocked by his friends. Verses 5 through 11, which is where we're headed now, he basically says, Job, you're a sinner, and he accuses him of extreme wickedness, and his iniquities are absolutely endless. And then he starts enumerating the sins. When you get down in verse 6, he starts enumerating. And one of the first things he talks about, he says, you have taken pledges for no reason. And this is something that's talked about in the book of Exodus 22. And he's saying, Job, you took pledges for no reason, unjustly. This left his brothers naked and shivering in the cold. So that he was taking unfair pledges, basically stripping them of their money, stripping them of their ability to have clothing. Verse 7, he accuses them of not giving the weary water to drink. Hospitality was an unwritten law, but not doing so was a very grievous breach of etiquette in Hebrew background. And therefore, Job was unmerciful to his visitors. And then he shifts over to the fact that Job had been a very mighty man and possessed a lot of land. And so what his insinuation here is that because Job was a mighty man and possessed a lot of land, by his power he had forced people to accept his control of the land, and thus he became a very wicked, great land baron. So that is really the kind of the insinuations that Eliphaz is making to Job up to this point. Let's flip over to verse 9. This is a very, very cruel charge here in verse 9. He says in verse 9, you have sent the widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. This is a really cruel charge. God, as we all know in studying the Old Testament, God has always been concerned with defending the fatherless, defending the widows. And he's saying, in this case, that Job was not. And again, I've got a couple references for you from Exodus 22 and Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 18. God's always concerned, always has been concerned with the fatherless and with the widow. And so this is really a low blow. He's accusing Job of being wicked to widows and to the orphans. And so it's a very, very serious charge. Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, up to this point, and as you recall, Marv, it's always just been generalities. You know, Job, you've sinned, you've done something. I guess they've come to the point in the debate, they've got to start accusing him of something. Because Job, as you remember, keeps saying, you know, in a court of law, you wouldn't even have a case against me. You've brought, you have no charges. You have nothing to bring up against me. So they're starting now to dig a little deeper and come up with some specific things that they mention. But no, there's no evidence of any wrongness of Job. They're just poking. Again, I think they're just poking at things. So, again, another charge.
Uh-huh. Well, God says, you know, look at my servant Job. And so, in God's eyes, Job was not a sinful man.
Right.
He
didn't practice sin. You know, he sins as much as anybody sins, but... It wasn't a habit, and Job knows his life was led in a righteous way for God.
And so he's defending himself against from the righteous point of view, and they're trying to find something to accuse him of.
It's almost, and yeah, I know we've all heard this expression, it's almost like they took a handful of mud and threw it against the wall and see how much would stick. And that's really what they're doing here. But all these, again, are just false charges. And so I don't know if I answered your question, Marv. Okay. Jack.
I think it's interesting to note they're not accusing him of idolatry, murder, any kind of fornication, which we in our mind might be worthy of the suffering that he's going through. If not taking care of the widow, not returning a guy's coat when you took a pledge for him at night, which was against the law, not defending the orphan. But these, in God's mind, they thought these were worthy of the suffering. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. And again, thank you, Jack. And there's no evidence, though, that you know any of this happened. I think they're trying to trump up some charges again. Did I miss any? Okay. We'll continue on then in verses 10 and 11. You're going to hear a lot of these references, and we've seen them already, of hunting snares and hunting gins. And so we get back into that again. He talks about the fact that, Job, you've got all kinds of snares around you, and you're going to get caught, is basically the idea here. So a gin or a snare would take Job by the heel. Snare surrounded him. Job would sense the sudden fear of judgment. And that's really verses 10 and 11. Eliphaz, again, offers no evidence to prove any of these charges. All this was a conclusion based on his theology, a.k.a., as Wade mentioned last week, his philosophy. And so this was just brought up as trumped-up charges. In verses 12 through 20, Eliphaz kind of changes his position, and he changes his thinking, and he now challenges Job to rethink his position. And so he points to God's dwelling place in verse 12. He says, is not God in the height of the heavens and sees the highest stars and how lofty they are? And you say, what does God know? Can he judge through the deep darkness? Basically, the thought here is that he's accusing Job of not recognizing God's might and God's dwelling place, and that Job basically thinks that God is too far away. God can't see what's going on. God hasn't seen the terrible things that Job has done. And so Eliphaz here points to God's dwelling place. And he says, the greatness and the majesty of heaven, Job's sins were shocking and horrible. And did Job really think that God didn't see them? That's really what he's trying to say here is, Job, do you think God didn't see these horrible things that you've done? Verse 13, again, more fanciful charges. He says, how can you say, what does God know? Can he judge through the deep darkness? So again, the accusation, Job was thinking, what does God know and can he judge through the great distance, the great darkness that separates us on this earth from God on his throne? BJ.
Is Eliphaz making a response to Job's claim that sometimes the wicked prosper? Eliphaz is interpreting Job's comment about that to say that Job believes that the reason they prosper is because God doesn't recognize their sin?
It's possible. I had a couple commentaries that stated, and Job also gets back into some of that. We'll get into a couple thoughts on that tonight, too, in chapters 23 and 24, when Job responds. He just, again, it's more of this trumped-up charge that you've done all these evil things, Job, and you think God hasn't seen it. And so that's kind of his shift. He's shifted this paradigm of, do you think God is blind to all these terrible things that you've done in your lifetime? Verse 14, Job, he says, he must think that God sees not. Thick clouds cover him, verse 14, so that he cannot see, and he walks above the circle of the heavens. Will you keep the old way which wicked men have trod, who were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away by a flood? Couple of things here in verse 14. First of all, Job must be thinking that God sees not and that these things were hidden from his view. And then Eliphaz here is stating that Job is saying in his heart that God is so completely removed from the affairs of men, he cannot see or know, and therefore Eliphaz virtually is charging Job of denying God's omnipotence and God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. And that's kind of a serious charge that... You know, he's basically saying, you think God just doesn't know what's going on. And so it's kind of another trumped up charge. Verse 15, he appeals to Job. He says, will you keep the old way which the wicked men of old have trod? Job should look at men of old that were wicked and looked at what happened to them. Look at consider their end. And then in verses 16 and 17, most of the commentators think this is a possible reference to the flood of Noah's day when he says, these same people were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away by a flood. And most of the commentaries, this being written probably in the patriarchal age, after the time of Noah, they think this is a reference to the wicked men that were cut down by the great flood. And so that's possibly what is being under consideration here, is he's referring to the evil and the wicked people that existed in Noah's day. But then he kind of shifts gears in verse 18, and he says, yet he, being God, filled their houses with good things, but the counsel of the wicked is far from me. The righteous see it and are glad, and the innocent laugh them to scorn. Surely our adversaries are cut down, and the fire consumes the remnant. In spite of the wickedness, Eliphaz says here, God sometimes fills their houses with good things, like he did for Job. You know, when I first started reading, I thought, wow, he's coming to his senses here. He realizes, yeah, that good things happen to bad people sometimes. But it's, again, the application to Job is that sometimes God gives bad people good things, Job, like you. And then in verses 19 and 20, it seems to refer to the gladness at the justice of God's judgment. And I put some verses up there that refer to that in Psalms 35, Psalms 58, Psalms 109, where there is rejoicing and there is gladness at the times that God pronounces judgment on the wicked. And so you can look those up. In verses 21 through 30, we shift gears again in the last part of this chapter. And Eliphaz makes an appeal for Job to return to God and pursue things that are more of a spiritual nature. And that's where he turns to in this last section. And so we'll go through these quickly. He says, basically 21, acquaint yourself, place yourself at God's service. Job was... To Eliphaz, Job was at war with God. And so he says, you need to be at peace with God, Job. Verse 22, he says, receive the law, Job. Lay it in your heart. Verse 23, return to the Almighty, because apparently in Eliphaz's eyes, Job had departed. Verses 24 and 25, Job should rid himself of precious metals, silver and gold. The Almighty would be his gold and his silver. So again, this is all his recommendations from his view of what Job needs to do. And then it's an if then. So then in verses 26 to 30, it's for then. So if you did these things, then, he says, there's going to be five blessings that are going to be received here in verses 26 through 30. And in verse 26, he compares new treasures versus old. Verse 27, he talks about that Job's prayers would be heard. Verse 28, decrees would be established. Verse 29, power would be lifted up and would be provided. And then, interesting enough, and I had to laugh a little bit on this one, Job would then have the power to deliver others. Well, that does happen at the end of the book of Job, because Job is asked to pray for and offer sacrifices for his three friends. So Job actually is given the power to deliver others, but it's them. And so very, very interesting set of accusations here by Eliphaz. Any other thoughts before we move into Job's response? Because now we're going to get into Job coming back with his responses. Okay, we're going to read chapter 23. It's a shorter chapter. Can I get another reader? It's 17 verses. Is there someone else that would like to read? Paul, can you want to read for us? Okay, chapter 23, verses 1 through 17.
Then Job answered and said, "Even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say unto me. Will he plead against me with his great power? No, but he would put strength in me. There the righteous might dispute with him. So should I be delivered for even forever from my judgment. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand, where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, that I cannot see him. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot hath held his steps. His way have I kept, and not declined. Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. But he is in one mind, and who can turn him? And what his soul desireth, even doth he do it. He performeth the thing that is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore am I troubled at his presence. When I consider, I am afraid of him. For God maketh my heart soft, and the Almighty troubleth me, because I was not cut off before the darkness, neither hath he covered the darkness from my face."
Thank you, Paul. He gets a little bit into what Donna brought up just a few moments ago. Midway through this, he says, "I have not departed from the commandment of his lips." Job says, "I have followed God." And that's kind of what Donna was alluding to earlier. And so we're going to talk about some of these things. Job basically is saying, "I'm innocent of horrendous sin. And if I'm tested, it's going to be like testing gold." He makes his complaint. In verses 1 and 2, he basically says that his complaint is very, very bitter. You might remember earlier in another chapter, he talked about that the finger of God had touched him. That's when he reached his great low point. The stroke of God's hand had been far heavier than even his groaning conveyed. So he's saying, even in what you've heard me groan and complain about, it's far heavier than that. And so he's really, really under a lot of suffering. Verse 3, Job wants to talk to God. He yearns for an opportunity to present his case before God in an impartial trial. And this recurs over and over again. He wants to meet God. He wants to be, in a legal sense, to be tried, and because he's confident he'll be found innocent of these horrendous charges. And in verse 4, it's interesting that Job says that I would present my case before him and I would fill my mouth with arguments. Job had not claimed any absolute innocence totally from sin, but he had lived a righteous life before God. And he's now being grievously mistreated by his friends, by those that lived in his household, his servants, and he wants to bring his case before the feet of the Almighty. He wants to bring it to God. And he is very confident, verse 5, that in Jehovah's court, he will be vindicated. BJ.
Well, I think it's interesting because you see Job's attitude change too. Because when you go back to chapter 9, Job was convinced that if he brought his case to God, God wouldn't listen to him. And you look at chapter 9 and verse 16. Yeah, if I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was actually listening to my voice. And so it's interesting as Job continues to hear them and recognizes their falsehood, the more he's convinced later that, no, actually, maybe I do have a case before God. Where at first he was very humble and said God wouldn't listen to me. Now he's pleading for God to listen. I'm sure that he would.
And I think that ties in, because BJ's exactly right. We're seeing a changed Job. We're seeing a Job that's looking beyond the pale of death and looking beyond, the Almighty, and is there life after death? And you might remember a couple weeks ago we talked about he reached his very, very low point when he said the finger of God had touched him. But then the high point in that chapter was, I know my Redeemer lives. And so I think we are seeing a changed Job. We're seeing a Job that's looking now. He thinks he's going to die, and he's looking now to standing before God and presenting his case. And so he is convinced, though, that he has been mistreated and that he will be vindicated. And in verse 6, it's interesting. He says that God would listen to him as a friend. And that's rather interesting. If you think about it, what Job has gone through, the only friend he has left is God. But yet he's still trying to figure out, why is God allowing all this to happen to him? And is it God behind all this? Verse 7, on the grounds of his innocence, Job feels he could stand before the Lord and be confident of being delivered forever from his judge. He gets into a compass type statement here. He says, look, I go forward, backward, to the left, and to the right. So he basically talks about basically the four points of the compass here in verses 8 and 9. And he says he has searched in all four directions of the compass, but he could not perceive God. You know, he cannot perceive God's presence. And so that is the reference there to up, down, left, and right. In verse 10, he affirms his innocence and his integrity and his faithfulness to God. Job reaffirms his confidence that God knows the direction of his life and all of his ways, and that he, Job, will come forth as pure gold. And we all know that gold is, when it's refined, it's run through the fire over and over and over again, and each time more of the dross and more of the impurities in gold fall out until you get pure gold. And so Job is saying, when I present my case before God, I will come forth as that pure gold. In verse 11, he mentions, the reference here is to his foot. He says, my foot has held fast to his steps, and I have kept his way and not turned aside. That word foot is a metonym for Job's whole walk in this life. He's saying, my whole walk in this life has been God's way. God's way was the pattern for his life. And we know that, as I think someone just mentioned a minute ago, God brags on Job at the start, says, have you not considered my servant Job? Following God and following God's way was the pattern for his life. In verse number 12, he says, the commandments of God, the words of his mouth. Job says he valued the words of God's mouth even more highly than the essentials of physical life, of actual physical food and the things that are necessary to this life. He says, more than necessary food, I think, in the translation I have at the end of verse 12. So he valued God's words more than even physical food. In verse 13, he recognizes the fact that God has a sovereign will, and who can change it? And then in verse 14, he kind of starts poking it. For he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. So he's basically saying, if this is God's desire for me to go through this, he is sovereign. And if it's God's desire for Job to be afflicted for his good, then Job was not aware of it, but God must have a reason for it. And that's really his thinking right here, is that he is not going to undermine God or underestimate what God's doing. He says God is sovereign, and you can't change God's being sovereign. If there's a reason all this is happening, I don't know what it is, but God must have a reason for it. And so really, he's proposing the question here, if Job suffers for some other purpose, what was it? You know, he's poking at, why am I suffering, and why is God allowing this to happen to me? He just doesn't know. He's out here reaching out, saying, well, I know God's sovereign, and there must be a reason for this, but I'm unaware of it. I do not know why, and I do not know how this is being allowed to happen. So he's struggling again with this idea of what is the purpose behind all this suffering I'm going through. Verse 15, he states that God has the power to carry out all his own desires and wishes. And then in verse 16, he gives two reasons that he says he has a faint heart here in verse number 16. He says, for God has made my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me. Basically, he's saying that Job has a faint heart, and he says right now he's being considered wicked even when he was innocent. And God's wrath had been very powerfully displayed in all of Job's suffering. So this gave him a very, very faint heart. And then the final thing in verse 17 is, I think he's alluding again back to the idea that he talks very earlier in the book about the desire that he wishes he would have just died at birth. In verse 17 he says, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, he did not hide deep darkness from my face. I think that's again a reference that he had wished he had died at birth, or he had been a stillborn, or you know, none of these things could have happened to him. So again, he's going back to this desire. He wished he had not been born. And so that's kind of his thoughts on chapter 23. Any thoughts on that before we move to the final chapter tonight? Okay, he's going to complain about some generalities here in chapter 24. And kind of the theme of chapter 24, it kind of resounded with me a little bit about the violence on the earth. We see a lot of that today in our world. And he's going to complain about some of the violence and some of the things he sees in his life with the wicked. And verse 1, he again desires an audience with God. In fact, his thought here, really in chapter 24 and verse 1, is that it would be nice if God had these kind of meetings where we could meet with him and discuss these kinds of things about the wicked. And that's really what the idea is why doesn't the Almighty hold such meetings for those that know him? And that's, I had a lot of commentaries had their two cents on this start of chapter 24, but that seems to be the idea, is that, again, he's asking for an audience with God, and wouldn't it be nice if God would come down and talk to the righteous and talk about the things that the wicked do? In verse 2, he talks about the fact that there are definitely wicked perpetrators that did wicked things in his lifetime. And one of the things, he gets specific now, he says one of the things that was done in his lifetime was that they removed landmarks and to rob other people and enlarge their own borders. In other words, if you had a property line, they would take that rock or whatever and move it a little farther to give them more land. And that was condemned in Deuteronomy 19 and 14. Another thing that Job lists about the wicked in verse 3 is that the wicked men would often drive away the donkey of the fatherless, and they would take the widow's ox as a pledge. And again, this would be, again, a reference to the orphans and to the widows and taking advantage of their situation and taking their donkey, their beast of burden, and their ox, and they would then not have the means of sustaining themselves and farming the land. Verse 4, the poor were forced to leave their pursuits and hide themselves from the violent, wicked man. Verse 5, he talks about that the victims, the orphans and the widows and others, were often like a wild donkey. They had to go out and seek a living on their own, And only by very diligent labor in a very harsh land were they able to eke out a living for themselves and their children. So the oppressive, rich, wicked man has taken advantage of people. He's saying, I've seen this in my lifetime. Verse number 6, he talks about the four that the poor had to cut the corn, and they actually tended the vineyards of the wicked. The wicked employed them, but they really had no concern for them. So the poor were out here cutting the corn down, although they were hungry, and tended the vineyards, although they were thirsty, and the wicked really had no concern for them. Verse 7, the poor victims of the wicked are forced to spend cold nights with insufficient clothing to protect their bodies. So this again is all Job's observations of his world and how he sees the wicked operating. Verse number 8, he talks about the four that the poor had to endure the mountain rains and that they hugged the sides of the rocks for shelter. I don't know if any of you have ever been hiking up on mountaintops. I know Jack's done that, but one thing you don't want to happen on top of a large, tall mountain is get caught in a thunderstorm, and you'll be clinging to the sides of the rock. And he's saying here that the poor often had to hug the sides of rock for shelter from these mountain rains. Verses 9 and 10, he gets a little more graphic. He says here that even the infant is snatched from its mother, and he's sold into slavery, and so many of them had to go about naked and hungry. They actually carried the sheaves, but they couldn't eat from them. They operated the olive presses, verse 11, making oil, and treaded the wine presses while they were thirsty. And the point is all these poor people that were taken advantage of, they were in the midst of plenty, but they lived in complete and total want because they were being of service to the wicked rich man who took advantage of his situation to them. Job saying, this is what I observe in my day. In verse 12, let me flip that over to the next page here. This expresses Job's thought that God manifests no concern for the social injustices of the land. This is, again, Job's thought. He says he just doesn't see that. He sees all this happening and he's pondering, does God even care that this is happening to the poor? In verse 12 he says, is not God in the height of the heaven and sees the highest stars and how lofty they are? And you say, I'm in the wrong verse. Let me get over here to the right verse. What verse was I reading?
12.
12, thank you. The dying groan in the city and the souls of the wounded cry out, and yet God does not charge them with wrong. So he's basically saying it appears that the wicked are able to do these things to the poor and take advantage of the poor, and God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. The rich, wicked people seem to be able to continue on. And so that kind of expresses his thought that it just appears that God doesn't generate any concern for these social injustices that he sees in the land. He moves on, though, and he talks about a different class of evil people. He moves on to murderers and thieves and adulterers. And in verse 13, he talks about a different kind of evil worker. These are people that murder people. These are people that steal in the night, people that commit adultery in the night. They reject the light, and they work in darkness. And he makes a couple references to the fact that murders always happen in the night. Adultery takes place at night. Men cover their face so they can't be seen as they're committing adultery. And so, again, it's this idea of this is another class of evil that he sees in his life. And such practices reveal the very cheap price put on human life by those who leave the way of the light. In verse 15, he talks about the adulterer thinks that no man will see him because he covers his face as a precaution. And point being, he fails to realize that all things, and we know this, all things are naked and laid open by the Almighty God. God is sovereign. God sees all things, and all things are laid open to him. And after the adultery, he talks again about the thief in verse 16. He says, the thief is one that will break into houses at night. And the houses that were apparently one of the things that they would do, thieves, a lot of the commentaries talked on this, was they would mark that house during the day. So they would walk around during the day and put some kind of a mark on which houses they wanted to hit at night. And so they would put some kind of a mark on that house and then hit that house that night and to rob it. And so thus we have a premeditated type of robbery going on here. So again, these evil things are done in the darkness of night. And verse 17, he says, their deep darkness is their mourning. You and I, most honest people, we do our work in the morning and throughout the day. These men escape the sight of other men, and they do their work at night. And they think that, but they cannot escape the sight of God. They think they cannot be seen, but God sees all things, whether in the day or in the night. And so this, again, is Job's observation. He talks about the fact that sometimes it appears even some of them get away with it. Verse number 18, he says, the thief silently and swiftly vanishes away like a light. And he makes a reference to a fast craft on the water. They seem to be able to bolt away. He says in verse 19 of this chapter, he says, as drought and heat consume the snow waters, so should the grave those who have sinned. And the wicked, the word consume there in verse number 19 really comes from the word violently take away. So he says, as the drought and heat violently take away the snow waters. I think the point he's trying to make here, and this was another tough verse by the commentators, is that what he's saying is likewise, Sheol, or the place of the dead, takes away, violently takes away the sinner, and he is seen no more. And that point seems to be continued in verse 20. He says, the wicked will be completely forgotten, and the maggot will consume his body. The memory of him will be gone. The body of him will be gone. Both will perish and will be completely forgotten. And his reference, his example, his metaphor here is just like a tree that is snapped off in a storm. That tree is going to die. It's going to decay. It's going to be gone and is going to be no more. In verse 21, we have again the repeats here of those that prey on the barren. Again, the cruel mistreatment, I think, is a reference here to the widow and the fatherless. The wicked tyrant does no good. He only does evil. So that's, again, a reference to these evil people. And then finally, the last three or four verses, and we're going to end up just right about on perfectly on time. In spite of the wickedness of the mighty men, Job saw their life, though still controlled by God's power and God's providence. Verse 23, he talks about the fact that God's eyes are on the wicked and he determines their ultimate destiny. Verse 23, he says, he gives them security and they rely on it, yet his eyes are on their ways. So even though they think they're getting away with things, God has his eyes on the wicked and he determines their ultimate destiny. And in verse 24, he talks about the fact that sometimes they'll be exalted, but it's only for a little while. He says, for they are exalted for a little while, and then they are gone. They are brought low, and they are taken out of the way like all others. They dry out like the heads of grain. So again, this idea that even though the wicked man will seem to flourish for a while, and the wicked man will seem to be exalted for a while, he will soon be gone, and there will not be a memory of him, and his body will be gone. And verse 25 is he's kind of summarizing what they have said versus what he has said about the wicked. And in verse 25, he says, now if it is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? Basically, he's saying, Job, to his friends, you guys have spoken to me from tradition. I just told you things I have done by observation of what I have seen in my lifetime. So his friends spoke of traditional thought about the wicked and the righteous. He says, I'm speaking to you by things I have observed in my lifetime. So Job is truly being honest here with his observations. And the point that we need to always realize from this is, even though God's justice is delayed, it never fails. It never fails. God will make all things right someday. And that seems to be the point that Job is alluding to here at the end, is that although the wicked seem like they're getting away with things, their end will come and justice will happen. So that's kind of those three chapters. Anybody have any final thoughts or questions they want to make on that? So that's 22, 23, and 24. BG will wrap up next week the third cycle, which is chapters 25, 26, which are very, very small chapters, 27 and 28. Next week. And I think it's, BJ, I think it's the following week is our gospel meeting, but anyway, the following BJ covering for me next week, we will get into Job talking about the past, the present, and the future, and that's chapters 29, 30, and 31. And so we're actually ending the cycles of debate.
We've got 2 more weeks of
classes. Okay, 2 more weeks of classes, and then we'll have our gospel meeting. So thank you for your comments and your questions. And again, the handouts are in the back if you'd like to have one. And BJ will cover next Wednesday. And we'll have handouts for next Wednesday as well. Thank you very much.